Policy to order, March 20th, 2007. I'd like to welcome everyone here today. The world is in bloom, all pink and white, and we should all be very, very happy. All right, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2814, and I'll call on Representative Brian Boker. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Representative Brian Boquist. I represent the 23rd House District, which is five rural counties in the Willamette Valley, which I share with several of the distinguished members here on the committee, and of course served as your co-chair during the interim on this committee. Madam Chair, members, before you today, you have House Bill 2814, and before I go further along in there, I just kind of explain. I mean, 2814 is one of those bills we all hate because it has all these blank lines on it, and it doesn't say how much it costs. And my intent was to raise the issue, which I'll talk about in a minute, and then determine, because it's a ways and means issue, at a later point, what is the appropriate response and what is the appropriate funding level of the response to the bill. Basically, what the bill does is it allocates funds from the general fund to the Department of Human Services for the purchase of antiviral medicines that combat a pandemic such as the avian flu. I think all of the members, rather than going into any of the issues of the avian flu, I think you're quite familiar with that, and so I'm just going to kind of run down a handful of issues for you and then get out of your hair and go back to my Agricultural and Natural Resources Committee. Presently, the Oregon plan, which Dr. Sue Allen will talk about later, proposes to purchase about 13,000 doses as a first strike mechanism in the state. The second portion of that plan relies on the federal government to come rescue us out of a federal stockpile that is kind of yet to be determined. You will see documentation later today that says Oregon's allocation from the federal stockpile is 460,000 doses. I have been trying, and in fact Dr. Allen now is going to help me, to get something in writing from the federal government, because every time we expect the cavalry to come from the federal government, for some mysterious reason, it never arrives. And having said that, when we start talking about the federal government coming to our rescue in a pandemic, I'd like to read you a quote from Michael Levitt, who is the director or the secretary of Health and Human Services in regard to this specific issue. And I quote, "I need to say with a clear and unwavering voice that any community that fails to prepare with the expectation that somehow the federal government will have resources to ride in and save the day will sorely be disappointed." I think this sounds like a page out of FEMA's handbook, frankly, and shouldn't be a real surprise to us. The real issue at hand today is, what is the level of preparedness we should have? Should we have 13,000 doses, as the good doctor recommends, or should we have 25%, which is what WHO, Health and Human Services, CDC, and at least 44 other states agree we should have, and their doctors and medical staff agree we should have? I'm not convinced the number is 25% response, but it is much higher than what we have right now. And as I pointed out to you, one of the issues at hand is, everybody's asked rather than that, well, what's our neighbors doing? We hear that in revenue. Well, what's the tax policy of Washington, or what's the tax policy of California? In regard to the pandemic issue and purchasing antivirals to stockpile, what are our neighbors doing? Utah is buying 246,000 doses to treat an initial phase of population. This is above and beyond whatever the federal stockpile may have or may not have. California is buying 3.7 million doses on our southern border. Washington to our north is buying 643,000 doses to our north. And Idaho is considering upping its purchase over on our dry border, where the good Representative Butler will be first hit. For once, something will come maybe from Idaho across our way. It won't be good, and he won't be able to explain or talk about the tales of all the people in his district leaving and going to Idaho for tax reasons. What is important in this bill, though, and is important in the state of Oregon, that is we cover or have the ability to cover our first responders. And again, I said the state plan is to purchase exactly 13,300. The first responders, I think all of you know, are comprised of fire and rescue personnel that respond, ambulance, police, National Guard, and I'll come back to that and talk about it in a few minutes when I talk about the National Response Plan, and then all of the medical personnel that would have to deal with the pandemic. If you add that together, the number is larger than 13,000. I don't think there's anybody here to debate that. I think there's people more qualified from the Department of Emergency Services that could tell us what that number is, but it is larger. I would point out to you that one of the interesting aspects of this, of course, it's a dollar purchase. But we're talking about purchasing antivirals in preparation for a potential disaster, the pandemic flu. I'd also point out to you that this chamber very recently just spent over $1 million to buy fire insurance to preserve trees and for fire protection. I know several members in here would like ODOT to spend $50 or $60 million for the Dundee bypass. Now, ironically, ODOT, if they have 7 or 8 accidents at an intersection, will spend $25 million to build a new intersection and an overpass to save 7 people. And in the case of Oregon in a pandemic, the modeling shows that we're talking about 21,000 lives. So the question is what is the value of 21,000 lives in comparison to fire insurance or even the Dundee bypass, which I do hope we build because it affects my district. One of the things that bothers me most is when a pandemic does happen, what is the national response? And I mentioned to you I have yet to receive in writing from the Department of Health and Human Services. I hope in the next couple of days to have that, exactly what the plan is, and does it provide a guaranteed resource to the state of Oregon? Right now I got the deer in the headlight look when I asked those questions to the federal government. What I would point out to you, though, is this lovely book right here. And I'm sure all of you have read this since you're in emergency preparedness. This is the National Response Plan. You can easily go to sleep in 5 or 6 minutes reading it. But buried in there, it tells you what the basic response is. One of the first things you do in a pandemic is quarantine. Now, that's a nice, pretty medical term, and I think Dr. Allen can talk to it from the medical side. But for the rest of you and some of the members, I think you know what quarantine means. That means we forcibly keep people in one location. When you have the states to the north, the states to the south, the states to the east, all quarantining their locations to ensure nobody else that's infected gets into their state, what we're talking about is having the National Guard and other emergency services out there enforcing a quarantine, both the state of Washington hypothetically enforcing it on their side and us enforcing it on our side. When it comes to the national stockpile, the question comes is, if it happens simultaneously, will we actually get those items? And if we try to go across even from Portland to Vancouver to seek medical assistance in a quarantine, will we be able to cross the river? Or likewise, will they be able to cross the river back to us? I think those are all questions that need answered. I think this committee can do an exceptional amount of work in addressing some of those issues. And then in addition, if this bill is moved downstairs again to Ways and Means, I'm not convinced that the number is 360,000. 25% of the Oregon population would actually be 750,000. I don't think it's that number. But I think at a minimum, the state of Oregon needs to address the issue of providing the capability to ensure police, fire, medical, and other emergency responders, including the National Guard, could be covered in this so that we maintain a safe environment, even in the middle of a disaster. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be delighted to take questions.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. I have one question, and then I'll go to you, Senator Marsette. Thank you. Representative Brokers, how would you answer the debate that the vaccine is not effective?
Madam Chair, it's a very interesting issue because what we're talking about is antiviral. Is we do have 6 states, 5 of which share Dr. Allen's, and Dr. Allen and I have had extensive conversations with this. We just respectfully disagree. We do have 5 states that agree with her position and agree with, well, there's no medical proof or no total proof that this is a perfect world and that both of these drugs hypothetically would work. On the other side, we do have the chief medical officials of 44 states, 44 other states, which kind of outnumber 6, In addition, we have the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, which we all quote. I mean, even Senator George, I've heard quote them before, even though we might not agree with them very often. But we do quote the CDC. And likewise, we have the World Health Organization, and we have a whole host of other professional organizations in the medical community. Unfortunately, and the doctors that are in the room will cringe, but we must remember that 100,000 individuals get killed accidentally every year by doctors. And so, not necessarily a science all the time. Sometimes medicine is an art.
All right, Senator Morissette.
How do we know the vaccine will work? That's her question. That was my question. We're going to use a generic vaccine that may have nothing to do with the strain of flu that we get. Now, is that a intermediate kind of vaccine that will hold us over until we get the real thing? If we ever, we probably won't. If there's a pandemic, we may not have any vaccine quick enough to do anything. So are you saying that the 25% that we would purchase is an effective anecdote, at least?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, what I'm saying is if it's the 25%, which again I think is maybe a higher number, it may be something lower than that, it has proven to be at least effective in combating it. It's kind of like, I guess the parable is, or the straight answer to your question is no, we don't know for sure how well it's going to work. And the second response to that is do we stand here and do nothing? Do we take something that the majority of the medical community has agreed will provide some treatment, some relief, and some hope, and we spread that hope amongst the population of the state of Oregon, or do we do nothing? I mean, there's our two choices. I don't have a scientific answer for you. I just look at the fact that you have 44 other states and all of their medical community is willing to take that risk, that it will provide some relief to their citizens, versus the opposite side. Now, hopefully I'm wrong.
Just one quick follow-up.
Hopefully
it doesn't do any harm. Are we assured it won't do harm? We don't know if it'll do good, but would it?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I have seen nothing in the reading over the last 2 years in the interim session to indicate that it would do any harm. There is some indication, I'll be first to admit, that if you don't purchase a balance of antivirals, that immunity from one drug can be developed. And that has been, in fact, pointed out in Asia and other places, and so therefore they switch to the other drug. So it's, again, when you're back and looking at hope and the art of this, you know, you don't buy 100% of one thing. You buy 50% of this, 75, 25, so you have the opportunity to have multiple chances.
Thank you.
All right.
Other questions? Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Cowan.
Thank you. In our information that was distributed with this bill is the piece that's entitled Government Purchase of Antiviral Medications for Public Health Protection. I don't find anything that's telling me where this information came from. It appears to be a compilation of quotes from various publications. Is this part of your testimony?
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, I don't recognize, if you maybe hold it up, I might recognize I have something in my, I don't recognize it at all. I do, in fact, Madam Chair, have, you know, reports from the World Health Organization sitting in front of me, which I'd be happy to share with the committee. I also have reports from the Infectious Disease Society of America, which actually goes to the heart of Senator Morissette's question, and I'd be happy to provide him or the entire committee with copies of this at your next meeting.
I would prefer, Representative, that you give it to the staff and that they provide the committee with it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Nelson and then Representative Shaw.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, Brian, because, you know, safety should be the top priority in our state, as you know, and I'm just curious at who makes the decision. I mean, are you saying the governor absolutely made the decision that this is not important, so be it? I just can't imagine our governor not thinking it's important to do this.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I think the decision was made, and the person to actually address that is in later times, and Dr. Sue Allen will be here from Health and Human Services, and she'll address that issue specifically. I did address a letter to the governor asking to reconsider the minimum purchase of $13,300. The governor's office did not respond to me and passed it back to Dr. Allen, and just respectfully, Dr. Allen and I agree to disagree.
Okay.
follow up, please?
I'm just wondering, what does it take? I mean, we have to march on the Capitol. We have to have a rally, to do what's prudent. What is recommended?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I think what is prudent, at least in my mind, is first determining what is an appropriate first response level. Is it 13,000, which I disagree is, or is it 50,000, 100,000, 200,000. And then the second thing is addressing it, frankly, in the Ways and Means Committee. Because in the budgeting process, as we all know, it's a balance. My point is that the balance is we're spending, I think, $1.3 million for fire insurance for a fire that may never happen. Spending $1 million or $2 million to protect the citizens of the state of Oregon might be a wise investment, along with the Dundee Bypass Center.
All right, Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. And Representative, I'm confident the safety, health, and welfare of the people of Oregon is the governor's number one priority. I'm absolutely assured of that. So I wanted to share that with you. These are questions of interpretation. And my question is not meant to be argumentative either, Representative. But I've been talking to people about this, and there's some question about the window of when these drugs would be applied, who would get them, how would they know they're going to get them. There's a lot of logistical questions here. And I'm just an old laborer. I don't know. And I'm glad to hear that there aren't dentists killing 100,000 people in the country, starting with me. But anyway, can you just speak to that, those who gets it, when, and how do they know, and how would we would apply that?
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, I think you raise a very good point, and the reason I think it's a good point is that, keep in mind, if we could draw from the federal stockpile, where is the federal stockpile? If the federal stockpile is in Atlanta, hypothetically, how are we going to get it from Atlanta to here through quarantines and everything else? How is the distribution? The state has been working, and to the credit of Dr. Allen and the emergency preparedness folks, has been working on a distribution system. But then it also comes back to how much of this product do you have to distribute? If you're only going to distribute 13,000, then it's pretty easy to say we're going to have it in these four medical centers. Actually, I think Dr. Allen will address you. They have kept it in reserve for a strike. So hypothetically, if it showed up in Pendleton, at the Stampede, the Pendleton Roundup, because someone brought it in on an airplane, that you could go into that one area there. Unfortunately, we found from the Spanish flu in 1918 that it moved in a matter of weeks across the world. And with modern air traffic, guess what? It can be here tomorrow. I think the first thing is establish what the level is. There is a fairly decent emergency preparedness system in place to distribute it. But here's you raise a good issue. Would a legislator get it versus a hospital worker? Because we are the government and we have to continue. Or would a fireman get it versus a police officer? And those are questions yet to be answered.
And then, Madam Chair, may I follow up? And this is the medical side of it. How do people know they have it in that? I understand it's a window of time, 72 hours. How do people know they have it and need it if they aren't feeling anything inside that 72 hours? Once again, I'm not saying we shouldn't do this. I just want to, that's some of the questions that have arisen, and I thought I'd ask the proponents of.
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, just to show you how much I do have faith in Dr. Allen, is that's a medical question, and
okay.
I think you should actually ask her of that. But I think, again, you raise a point. If it's the third day and you realize that you have it and now it's time to react, how much reaction time do we have? And, do we have Evergreen's aircraft to fly it from Atlanta to here, or are they already flying it to California, and did California already take all of it? Those are all questions that I think need slightly more exploration.
Great, thank you.
Other questions? All right. Thank you very much. We'll let you go back to your ag and natural resources and figure out what you're going to do there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will make copies available to your staff on that, and I look forward to discussing this in the future, and I'd be happy to meet with any of the members of the committee individually.
And, Madam Chair, may I briefly, 30 seconds, if we're going to insure all that timber out there, we should start using some of it, too. I just thought I'd share that with you, too.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to just say something, too, if I could. You're working on this. Well, why don't you try to get protection for our volunteer firefighters that we've not been able to get for four terms against hepatitis C?
I agree, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. Dr. Susan Allen.
Madam Chair.
I'm pass all those questions on to you. Every time Representative Shoffler says that He's just a laborer. I think about the guy that was just a country lawyer. Do you remember the guy that held the hearings that was just a country lawyer and outsmarted everybody? So.
And Madam Chair, when I said that in Representative Jensen's Water Committee, he'd always say, everybody grab their wallets.
Uh-oh. All right, welcome, Dr. Allen.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Dr. Susan Allen. I'm the State Public Health Director in the Department of Human Services, and thank you for the caution about just a country farmer or anyone else on the committee. I appreciated the questions that were raised. And let me be clear, I do appreciate very much Representative Boquist's interest in preparing the state for being able to address pandemic influenza or another serious disease outbreak. As he has already said, there are many important points on which he and I do agree, and that this needs to be taken seriously and that we are taking it seriously is one of them. I also appreciate and agree very much with his sentiment that we should especially look at the concerns of how we can protect emergency responders in the medical community and other forms, other people who are also emergency responders. That is, for our emergency planning for health and medical issues, one of our prime considerations as well. Where he and I do have a difference of perspective is on the relative value of Tamiflu and other antivirals as part of the many faceted response and planning that we have to do for pandemic flu or for other disease outbreaks. One of the provisions that he made a statement that this drug should be purchased because it could help save 21,000 lives. If we had good evidence that it would save 21,000 lives, I might very well have a different recommendation for you. The concern that I have is that the evidence of the medication as used and as recommended in that very thick national response plan that he showed, there's no strong evidence that it would save lives at all. It would reduce illness, and it might reduce the spread of the disease somewhat, but quite modestly relative to the cost and relative to the effort it would take to distribute it. If we were to have purchased the full amount recommended under the federal plan for Oregon, it would be $5.3 million, which is a considerable amount of money, especially when you figure that our annual budget for all of public health, our general fund is about $20 million. So that would exceed a quarter of the whole state investment in public health currently. That does not by itself say that it might not be worthwhile, but I want to put in perspective that I need to think in terms of relative value on behalf of the state for the investment related to other things that might also be done with a comparable amount of money. Tamiflu and similar antivirals don't work with all viruses. That was mentioned. Currently, it works with a little over 80% of the strains of flu that are out there. So up close to 20% might not work with. Its greatest value is when it's used in a way quite different from what the federal proposal is. Where it is of greatest value is when you use it in a medical care setting for people who are taking care of people with flu, and they're taking it preventively every day over time. That requires a huge amount of medication, and that is not the proposal that's in the federal plan. The federal plan is that it would be used for people, and as was raised as a question, for people who've been exposed and right around the time the symptoms start, just before or after their symptoms start. So basically, you would be looking at one course of treatment per person at the time that they're starting to get sick. When used that way, on average, the impact is it reduces the duration of the illness by about a day and a half, which is over a large population. It might get your police back to work a little sooner. It might get your nurses back to work a little sooner. It's not saving lives. It does reduce hospitalizations, but rather minimally. You have to treat about 140 people to reduce the number of hospitalizations that would happen. And with very seriously ill patients, there's some hope that it might help reduce their mortality rates, but there's no good evidence that it would do that. So it would be very speculative about how life-saving it would be. And again, not only is the cost significant, in addition, there would be the cost and the trouble of storing it. It expires within about 4 years, so you'd have to hope that you had the pandemic in the next 4 years, I'm sorry to say, or you'd have to renew the stockpile or have some system for turning it over. I'm not pinning naive hopes on getting the portion of the federal plan. There is a federal plan out there, and there will be a federal stockpile, which would bring a very significant amount to the state, probably. We have good plans for how to distribute this, but frankly, one of our problems with any of these systems is that the state's public health staffing across state and local health departments is very modestly funded, and a lot of the federal funding was going, I'm afraid, for stuff, not staff. And when you get things delivered, you also need the pipeline, the delivery system, for getting it out there. So we've been trying to put our efforts into increasing the capability of the medical care providers, the health departments, to not only get Tamiflu out if that came in, but if we had a vaccine that was arriving because it was a different kind of drug or a different disease for which other treatments were needed, our recommendation would be that the investment should be in the staffing in the local health departments and the state health department, which would create the ability to address lots of different diseases, not just $5 million invested in one single disease, which might or might not come. With respect to the point about what other states are doing, the deadline for submitting a letter of proposal to purchase the Tamiflu was the 29th of December, just passed. Most states, the 44 states that Representative Boquist mentioned, submitted a letter to keep open the possibility to purchase it. Very few of them have actually submitted significant purchase orders. And I know from talking to my colleagues in other states that they did not feel that from a public relations perspective, they could say they weren't purchasing it. So it was set up to be purchased as need and available funding allowed. And most of them are not expecting, this is personal discussions, are not actually expecting that the full amount that they kept the door open for would be purchased. There are a few states who have invested fairly heavily in this. With respect to the point that was made about quarantine, I'd like to assure you that in a pandemic influenza situation, the only quarantine or isolation that would be recommended would be voluntary. There's absolutely no proposal, and in fact, I was part of a couple of national studies with the CDC and with HHS, including a work group with Secretary Leavitt directly, looking at the value of different kinds of measures in protecting against influenza. And the recommendation would be made that people who are sick be strongly encouraged to stay home, that people who are in families of someone who's been exposed, who has exposed them to the flu, be encouraged, if possible, to stay home until their kind of course of exposure had passed. But there will not be any recommendations for forced use of law enforcement or the National Guard in a pandemic influenza situation to contain the disease or to stop interstate travel or anything like that. That is actually not part of the plan for this disease. There may be other questions I didn't get to answer quite yet.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Yes. Senator Marcet.
Thank you. How long would it take to get a flu that matched the virus? In other words, it takes time to produce a flu vaccine.
Yes.
Is what I meant to say, the flu vaccine. So how long would that take?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, the antivirals are a common drug that would be tried with a wide range of types of flu and might or might not work. The vaccine, the most optimistic guess is that it would be available within 6 months, but it could take much longer than that to produce enough of it to really distribute it widely. One of the more constructive uses of the federal money that went into the pandemic flu planning is being invested in changing the way vaccines are produced to try to move towards cell culture that could rapidly speed up how quickly vaccines could be produced. So they hope within a few years to have ways to do it within weeks to months instead of where we are now, 6, 9, 12 months as the time frame. If I may, one other point. The federal government, when they first rolled out their planning for pandemic influenza, there was a lot of publicity around the stockpile and around Tamiflu. The federal health officials at National Institutes for Health and at the CDC have since then significantly backed off on what they are recommending as the value for this. And in conversations in some of the work groups I was on at the national level, I was able to confirm with them that the media had picked up an exaggerated sense of the value of these as a component of the planning. So they themselves were saying that this would be at best a support and secondary role, but not the primary crux of a response to pandemic influenza in the event it ever happened.
All right, Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The media exaggerating, what a shock. I have a couple questions here. On the letter of the leaving the door open to potentially purchase a certain amount, we didn't do that, and I understand you correctly, and I, for the life of me, I don't understand why we didn't just leave the door open. I would like that explained. And then what if the other 44 states, if something bad happens, is that door still open to all states? And then on the shelf life, I understand it's 5 years, and even that may be questioned, that it could be even longer. If I need to repeat any of those, I will.
Madam Chair and Representative Shoffler, let me try to get through most of those.
That's
anyway.
Okay. Thank you.
With respect to the time frame, there is some speculation about whether there would be circumstances under which the life expectancy, the viability of the drug, could be extended. It still is finite, and you know the value of this only exists as long as the pandemic happens while the drug is still viable. With respect to the other states purchasing it, I'd like to make clear, I did not make this decision by myself. I agree with it, but I did not make this by myself. We consulted very widely within the state's other medical consultations with the director of the Department of Human Services, with the governor's staff, with other health care providers and hospital administrators in the state. I don't want to suggest that all of them agreed 100% with this perspective, but there was no significant disagreement and there was significant concurrence with this decision. Based on that, and again with a double check with the DHS director and the governor's office, we submitted a letter saying we did not intend to purchase it because no one could identify the circumstances under which we would purchase it. And part of what I wanted to do was be honest that if there were other states who wished to buy more than their recommended share, it was part of good citizenship, to be honest, that our share would not be purchased by us and therefore could be redistributed if there were others that did want it.
Senator George?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Doctor, in your statement, you make the following statement. Japan, where it is more frequently used, and then you use a number talking about resistance of Asia, apparently they believe that it's worth using or they wouldn't have developed the resistance. What is your analysis of that, the idea that Japan and other places in Asia appear to be using the material? Are they continuing to do that as best you know?
Madam Chair, Senator George, I don't want to suggest that there is no value to Tamiflu in certain circumstances. It is a value certainly in a nursing home. If you started to have an outbreak in a nursing home and you could use it in a preventive way with the staff and in order to minimize the spread in a nursing home, for example. So it is a potentially useful and valuable drug. And the healthcare systems are set up to make available those services to people who are willing to pay and that for which they can pay. So as an individual treatment or in something like a nursing home, it has been tried and tested and does have some value. The recent experience in Japan has also been showing some rather troubling side effects, and there's a lot of speculation that maybe it should not be used simply to reduce the duration of flu in people who are otherwise reasonably healthy, because they were in some of the younger people it was used and they were finding some significant behavioral and neurologic side effects. These are fairly recent reports and are still being explored. But there are some cautions being raised, actually, on the increased use of it in Asia that are starting to suggest it may not be as benign when used casually as people had assumed it was previously.
There is an issue, as far as I'm concerned, and that's if the people believe that they're in an influenza outbreak, that there is the possibility of something helping, and we don't have it. I personally believe that the idea that there might be treatment available would have a calming impact as compared to the possibility of exaggerating as a hysterical reaction. What is your thought on that?
Madam Chair, Senator George, I think that it is very important to recognize that people will be anxious and that we will have to have systems and conscience means to help people be reassured and to protect people to the extent we can protect them in some ways. There are a couple of reasons I'm not sure that misleading them in the value of a medication is the best way, though, to allay their fears. For one thing, there is a cost to distributing a low-value drug. If we did have a pandemic, the medical care system, the public health department, and police and fire and EMS will be very busy. And I would prefer that they be busy doing things that have a demonstrated value. We know something about distributing medications around the state because we distribute flu vaccine and children's vaccines, for example. And these are very laborious activities. We have a good system, so we are prepared to do this if needed. But if they're doing this rather than helping with other community control measures, we may actually be doing more harm than good. I also do believe that we have a long-term credibility issue, and I would like to build for people to understand how to take the best measures to protect themselves across a whole range of diseases rather than squandering our credibility by giving them something that experience will show actually did not accomplish as much as people believed it might. I think that could turn against us for planning for other emergencies and addressing other disease situations later on. It is a touchy issue, and the issue of giving people reassurances is something that we would need to pay important attention to.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you. Madam Chair, the first question, and then I'll have a follow-up. Again, this piece of information that's in our packets entitled Government Purchase of Antiviral Medications for Public Health Protection, I'm trying to locate the source because it isn't identified on it as to who authored this information.
Yeah.
Representative Cowan, I had a Hasina Squires drop off a packet.
Okay, so then she's going to testify. Okay.
No, she's not. Representative, she's not in her head. She's not going to testify, but she gave it to us.
It's identified at the bottom of the document.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, yeah, Roach.
All right, follow up.
Mm-hmm. Let me just clarify my understanding of what I've heard then. And in looking at that, I think it is important. This document that I've been referring to is supplied to us by the pharmaceutical industry. And I think that's important to know who's selling in the item that we're talking about. Dr. Allen, if I heard you correctly, and to me what I take away from the conversation is although people would like to be reassured during any kind of a potential outbreak, this particular medication is not a cure. There isn't any evidence that it's going to save lives. It's going to reduce the course of the illness for a day or two. except perhaps in very fragile populations. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, yes, that is a fair statement. If I may add the qualifier, when used as proposed in the federal pandemic flu plan, there are other ways this medication could be used that would be potentially more valuable, but would also take a lot more than anyone is proposing that we would have.
Thank you.
Okay. Follow up.
And I think it's also important for us to remember that it has a four-year shelf life, that we could spend $5 million purchasing a medication that would no longer be useful after 4 years. And the other item that I would like to ask you to expand on a little bit, because it's been mentioned several times, but I'm just wanting to make sure everybody fully grasps, is the challenge of the delivery system and the local public health ability to respond to this. We heard some mention of the hysterics, and from my experience, that's a very, very real problem that we have to address when there's any kind of a challenge to the health in our communities, is people get scared, and they respond by kind of storming, if you will, the courthouse or the public health departments. And it's a huge challenge to simply tell people what the everyday precautions are about protecting yourselves and what can and can't be done and what will and won't work. And certainly refusing people a medication they think they ought to have, whether it's exactly right for them at any given time, is very difficult. So I really would appreciate it if you'd expand just a bit on the challenges to our local public health delivery systems that we're trying to address, and maybe even what this $5 million could do in that respect.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, the point you're raising is very important, because there are lots of diseases that might come besides influenza, and the same system that would have to deliver Tamiflu or vaccine if it were available is the same system that we depend upon for any other disease outbreak or health emergency that arises. And it's a system that is very, very thin right now. We have many local health departments which have 4 to 8 staff. And a single norovirus outbreak in a nursing home right now is enough to challenge them, when what they need to do is actually come in and do direct kind of medical assessment and care. In the event of a pandemic, their greatest value will be in helping people in the community minimize the spread of disease through a lot of non-pharmaceutical measures, things that don't use drugs and vaccines, helping people understand how to improve hygiene, helping businesses figure out how to increase the natural distance between people, and a study group that the CDC and the Institute of Medicine were involved with recently that I was part of showed that those will be very powerful measures, actually. They sound like common sense, but they prove both from history and from some computer modeling that those would actually be very powerful in reducing not only the spread of disease, but the mortality in many ways. And that's what our local health departments would need to be doing, is getting good information to people, helping improve what hospitals, nursing homes, retirement homes, and schools are doing to minimize the exposure and the hazards at that time. But with the current staffing, this also is their opportunity to provide information to the public. So this is where the reassurance and the positive, authentic information to the public would come in, and having that direct activity. The distraction of, if they needed to do both that and distribute a medication, of perhaps contributing somewhat less to what would be going on in the community, I think our communities would be harmed. We would be far better off for even the emergencies that we see now with a norovirus or a contaminated spinach outbreak, if we had more disease control and public health education staff in all of our communities than we currently do.
Dr. Allen, I'm going to allow one more question, Representative Shoffman, then we must move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Yeah, you kind of touched on it there, too. Let's say even if we had X 1,000 courses of this, and we had a serious pandemic, we wouldn't have enough for everybody. Then you're doing planning to how people could treat their families, take care of themselves. We're doing things like that to educate the public. And that's kind of what, you know, what are we going to do if we have it or not have it, if there is some widespread pandemic, and what can we as just regular folks do? That's what I think we should be definitely concentrating on, too.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I agree with that point entirely. It does appear that telling people how to take care of themselves works better when they're anxious than it does on an average day. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to make sure that there would be a lot of just-in-time information, but we have this is already pre-written and ready to roll out and has been tested in the communities. We also, with respect to if there were vaccine that was available or there were some medications with the stockpile that came in, there would have to be prioritization, and we're involved at the state level with a medical advisory group that we've convened that is attempting to establish practical medical and ethical guidelines for how prioritization of the use of scarce vaccines or scarce medications would be used in an event so that people would at least know what's going on, and whether they'd all be happy or not, I don't know, but at least they'd understand what it was and that it was an external process, not just a decision our department made.
All right, Dr. Allen, thank you very, very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2814, and I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 790. And Senator Deckert is here. I think he stepped out. Would somebody please tell him to come back in? Jim, in the meantime, tell us what this bill is about.
Yes, ma'am. Senate Bill 790 places moratorium on leasing for purposes of exploration, development, or production of oil, gas, or sulfur in territorial seas. It excludes exploration for scientific or academic research purposes or geological survey activities. It requires that exploration for oil, gas, or sulfur in territorial sea conform to standards of the Oregon Ocean Resources Management Program, sunsets January 2nd, 2012.
All right. Thank you very much, Jim. Welcome, Senator Deckert, and anyone else you'd like to bring up with you.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair and our other co-chair.
Well, that leads right into an announcement I need to make. Our other co-chair, Representative Debbie Boone, has had surgery on Monday, and the report back is she's doing very well. And she will be leaving the hospital in a couple of days and going home to recuperate. So thank you for giving me an opportunity to make that announcement.
You bet. And Madam Chair, I believe, and it's Ryan Deckard, State Senator from Washington County, I believe she is a co-sponsor of this bill, and hopefully it has made its rounds through the Coastal Caucus, but there's not really a great deal of information I can give. A constituent contacted me about this, the moratorium that we have on offshore oil drilling in about July of this year. I said, that sounds like a good idea. Let me do the first step, which is to get something drafted on it, and then let my colleagues who represent the coastal communities in the state have a chance to vet it also, and I think this is the first step on that journey. It does, as I say, to me, meet the first test of we have and have in state law protected our public beaches, and we have one of the most beautiful, rugged coastlines in the world. The idea, I grew up at least in my first years in Texas, and obviously they are a state that has a history of offshore oil drilling, and the thought of having those large platforms off the Oregon coast would be something that, as only a tourist and a lover of Oregon's beaches, just to me would seem like an anathema to who we are. And so we've had a moratorium on it, and I would urge at least consideration, and I appreciate your consideration of this, Madam Co-Chair, to extend that moratorium on offshore oil drilling on Oregon's coast. And thank my coastal colleagues for allowing a non-coastal senator to join my other coastal senators in co-sponsoring this legislation.
Thank you, Senator Deckard. Next.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeremiah Bauman. I'm an environmental advocate with OSPIRG, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I am also here in support of Senator Deckert's bill, SB 790. Osprey came to this issue because about 2 years ago, the U.S. Congress started considering opening the federal moratorium on drilling in federal waters. We got very seriously engaged at that point and did some work both talking to our congressional delegation and also going out around the state talking to people door to door. What you can see on the screen here is actually photographs sent by Osprey members from around the state of their experiences of the coast when they heard that there was an attempt in Congress to open the coast to offshore oil drilling. And these photographs are just delightful, so I couldn't resist the opportunity to share them with you. It's literally hundreds of citizens around the state. This is their reaction to the idea of offshore oil and gas rigs. Let me just make a couple of brief points on this issue. It goes without saying that the coast for Oregonians is just an amazing place. Certainly for the many, many thousands of Oregonians who make their home there, for the businesses and communities that thrive there, for the natural resource economies that have for so long been the basis of our state's economy, it's incredibly important. But I think it plays a unique role in Oregon also because citizens from across the state think of the coast as a cherished place. It's hard to find an Oregonian who doesn't have a memory of family vacations or family reunions on the coast, whether it's at Seaside or Cannon Beach or the Oregon Dunes. And so it's an incredibly important place for Oregon. Or Newport.
Or Bandit.
Or Bandit. And I think as such, it's a resource we would not want to put at risk for the many, many environmentally damaging consequences, long-term consequences that come with oil and gas drilling. It's, of course, familiar to most Americans what happens when there's an oil spill. Images of birds and wildlife soaked in oil and beaches tarnished are hard to forget, whether it's Exxon Valdez or the spill that actually triggered the initial protections for the Oregon coast from oil and gas drilling, a spill in Santa Barbara, California in 1971. However, the damage caused by oil and gas extraction goes far beyond the effects of a single oil spill. According to the Minerals Management Service, which is the federal agency that oversees offshore oil and gas extraction, they list the following as, quote, unavoidable consequences of offshore oil and gas drilling: erosion of wetlands, air pollution, contamination by toxic chemicals, dumping of industrial waste and debris, and declining fish populations. And these are the results of the standard operations, not accidental spills. A single drilling rig typically drills between 50 and 100 wells, each well dumping as much as 25,000 pounds of toxic metals into the ocean. And a single rig can actually create as much air pollution as 7,000 cars driving 50 miles every day. So it's a significant environmental impact. And you can imagine that's not just about the impact on the aquatic ecosystems and the wildlife, but it's about the impact that would have on the coast and its tourism industry and its fishing industry. In fact, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has suggested that as the federal government begins a survey of offshore oil and gas reserves off the east and west coasts, consider initially not looking at Oregon and Washington because of the potential impacts on the salmon population of allowing any oil or gas exploration here. Now, of course, the main question is what kind of a threat is there actually? There are the primary threat right now is political. The U.S. Congress, well, politics there have certainly changed in the last several months. For the last several years, there's been increasing pressure. The Energy Policy Act of 2005 included a survey of offshore oil and gas reserves that was widely seen as the first attempt to start opening up the east and west coasts, which have been under moratorium for more than 25 years, to oil and gas extraction. And last summer, a bill passed in the House of Representatives to lift that moratorium for the entire east and west coasts. So the federal waters are at risk, and that is one place. However, Oregon, in its territorial waters, had a moratorium in place until 1995, and that expired in 1995. My understanding is that was largely because it was perceived the threat had passed. Well, I think the threat is back, and I think it's one that we as Oregonians ought to take leadership in addressing. It's also my understanding that right now no one's actually trying to exploit the Oregon coast for oil and gas extraction, so I think this is an opportunity to protect our coast before we have someone who's already coming in here and someone else's livelihood is put on the table. Let me just flag one small issue for you before closing. That is, while Oregon has relatively small reserves of traditional oil and gas, There are reserves out there. It's estimated at about $200 million worth of oil and gas reserves after accounting for the cost of extraction. There's another resource out there which we're probably 10 to 15 years away from being able to extract, but which I think we should take the leadership again, saying right now we want to protect our coast and keep it safe for communities, keep it safe for the environment that draws the tourism and for the fishing industry that draws its livelihood from those waters. That threat is something called methane hydrate, a substance most people have never heard of. It's essentially a solid form of methane, which is the same substance as natural gas, that forms under extremely unique environmental conditions. In this case, the place where the two tectonic plates on the bottom of the Oregon, the seabed off the Oregon coast, meet, is where this substance forms. The energy potential of methane hydrate is, in U.S. waters, is estimated at 200 times the conventional natural gas reserves. But you get the same exact environmental damages to the coast and to the communities there that you'd get with oil or gas drilling. And not only that, methane is an extremely potent global warming pollutant. Causes global warming much more rapidly than carbon dioxide does. And so for those reasons, we would urge that the legislature specifically exempt any methane hydrate from being considered as we consider renewing the moratorium on oil and gas extraction. With that, I'll close, and of course, happy to take any questions.
All right, thank you very much. Questions? All right, Senator George.
You know, I asked this question a few years ago, and I was told by the Department of Energy there wasn't anything out there. Yeah, what I hear you saying is what I saw when I saw a report talking about known energy reserves, and the coast of Oregon was listed as one of the larger reserves of known energy. Now, which one is it? Is there a large amount of energy, or is there no energy?
Madam Chair, Representative George, my understanding is that there's a relatively small amount of energy in the form of traditional oil and gas reserves. So the number I have, which I believe is from the Minerals Management Service, their most recent estimate was $200 million in net value, which is actually calculated at $48 a barrel oil, so it's probably more than that now. Which is small. Out of 15 areas around the West and East Coast, it was the smallest. That said, of course, as the price of oil continues to rise, smaller and smaller reserves will become more and more profitable. The place where we see an extraordinarily large reserve is on this substance called methane hydrate, which I would guess if you asked the Department of Energy about oil and gas, they probably wouldn't even look at methane hydrate because right now no one's extracting it. Japan's trying to extract it. Alaska is starting to talk about it a little bit, but it's still about 10 to 15 years away, I think.
Other questions? Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I misunderstood or didn't hear clearly. When you're talking about the methane hydrate, are you saying that we, even if a moratorium was passed, that you would think we should be able to access that? Is that what you're saying? Or is that should be part of the moratorium?
Madam Chair, Senator George, thank you. I realized as I was saying that I was not being clear what I was exempting it from. Yeah. We believe it should be part of the moratorium. The environmental damages from extracting methane hydrate would be at least as bad as from traditional oil and gas extraction, and possibly worse because of the global warming consequences of that methane being the way they would process it on the rigs. So we think it should be part of the moratorium. There should be no extraction of methane hydrate.
I have a question for you. I'm told that the way that they used to drill for oil and gas is quite different today, that they have had to comply with environmental regulations, and that if what you're saying is true, that you actually would not be able to work today, and so that it is not as harmful, and that it's a totally different process. How do you respond?
Madam Chair, my understanding, this is actually from the Federal Minerals Management Service, which is currently, I think, promoting offshore oil and gas extraction. Their estimate of the current technology, they say that the current technology being used in California poses a 95% risk of an oil spill of less than 1,000 barrels at a time, so a relatively small oil spill. 1,000 barrels is about 42,000 gallons. And a 40% risk of a larger oil spill, larger than 42,000 gallons. So even with the best technology, and it's true they've come a long way in cleaning up his operations, there's still a relatively high risk of a decent-sized oil spill.
Other questions? Okay, Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. as I've read this methane hydrate, especially off the coast of like Florida, for instance, is looking at it as a huge resource because of the fact that they have so much of it apparently in those plates. In fact, there's even some situations where apparently it releases naturally and has been known to maybe even cause the sinking of some ships in the Bermuda Triangle. So there's some discussions about that. These are natural releasing entities. I mean, the methane hydrate releases naturally into the water. And so it seems like to me it's a huge opportunity for us to tap into a resource. And I look at a moratorium like this, and I know that state of Alaska, state of Texas, state of all around the Gulf Coast, they draw a huge amount of money for their state revenues from this type of extraction, which pays for schools, which pays for environmental protection, which pays for all of these things. It seems like to me like a moratorium such as this could really have huge impacts on what Oregon could do eventually for the citizens of the state if we actually tapped into some of those resources that we have right off the coast, especially if it was done in an environmentally sensitive way. So I was just wondering if you could comment on the natural release of methane hydrate, and then, of course, the revenue impact that you're going to have on us trying to educate kids, trying to take care of environmental protection in the state if we don't use these resources.
Madam Chair, Senator George, I can't comment a whole lot on the natural release of the methane hydrate. I know one of the main questions scientists have right now is about the cycle that happens between the natural release of some of it and the natural reprocessing of it back into the sea bottom. One of the biggest reasons some scientists are concerned about rushing to extract it is they don't understand that process very well. They don't understand what role that is already playing in global warming, and therefore what the impact of bringing that up to the surface and releasing it might be. Beyond that, I don't know. And I certainly don't know about the Bermuda Triangle, although I'm very curious about that. We should look at what's happening off the Oregon coast near that ridge. In terms of the revenue impact, again, I guess the main way I look at this is we're a long ways away from being able to extract that methane hydrate. So there certainly isn't any short-term revenue we're missing the opportunity for. So I don't see it as a very big choice that we have to make today. I think we can afford to protect our coast. And, you know, the legislature, of course, can always relook at technologies as they evolve if that does become a resource that's available. Osprey's perspective on that is, I don't think it's in a very good long-term interest of our state to tie our revenue streams to natural resource extraction that we know is going to have a long-term harmful environmental consequence. I think it sets us up for a lot of the same debates that have been very divisive between urban and rural Oregon in recent years, because of revenues tied to timber harvest. And I think that that's not the kind of experience we'd want to be recreating for our state by tying our revenues to those extractions. And then even if that opportunity were to present itself, it's a pretty hard choice, I think, for residents of the coast. Do you want to live with the air pollution and the toxic contamination and the oil spills to get money for the schools, or do you want to find other revenue streams? That's the question facing us, I think.
All right. I'm going to call...
Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I could just say one thing.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I had a very simple notion, and that's why we chose a relatively short sunset in this, and it was very dissimilar to what is happening geopolitically and what is happening certainly in Washington, D.C. along these issues. And the simple notion was to do something similar to California and other states with a population that loves their coast. And I think if there was a project that was at least planned, we would see an uproar from citizens. And so I think it was along that spirit to choose a short sunset and to, if we could, put blinders on to what is happening in geopolitical terms, what is happening in Washington, D.C., and that whole world, and basically look at as Oregonians, is this a wise move for a relatively short period of time, understanding we don't know what's going to happen and being sensitive to that and watching that, but having some sort of protection in place for a short period of time rather than getting into larger, bigger conversations that could come our way, and a short sunset allows you that opportunity to watch, monitor, but also know that the state's made at least a short-term decision along those lines.
Thank you, Senator Decker.
Madam Chair, could I get one more question in?
I've got to manage time here, but I'll allow one question.
I promise it'll be really quick.
All right.
After thanking you for the tourism promotion, I just want to know if oil, gas, or sulfur in this verbiage, does methane hydrate need to be added to that in order to address the concerns that you have?
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries basically believes under the current definitions it's a little unclear. There are some definitions in an unrelated part of the statute that refer to gas being a fluid, which isn't true of methane hydrate, but given this isn't amending that specific part of the statute, that wouldn't necessarily apply.
I thought it was yes or no. I'm sorry.
Yeah. For certainty, I think we could add a definition to specifically include methane hydrate.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to call Steve Purchase from the Department of State Lands. Nice to see you, Mr. Purchase.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director of Department of State Lands. I did not provide any written testimony because I'm going to try to keep my testimony fairly short because I know you're on a quick time frame. Department of State Lands supports this legislation as proposed because it does have that short sunset clause that will allow us time to evaluate any potential oil and gas development or methane hydrate development that would occur on the Oregon coast. One of the reasons that we looked at supporting this bill is that we are very sensitive to the extraction natural resource, including our fishing industry, which we'd also like to try to protect and make sure that that is not harmed should there be a oil release or anything like that coming from this kind of development. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions of the department?
Only to comment, Madam Chair, if we're worried about our fish, then let's start taking them pinnipeds out east of the bridge. If we're really worried about our fish. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you could you explain to me the flow of dollars that the state gets when we if we had some kind of extraction in our territorial waters? How would that money, because it's in the state land, so therefore would those lease payments be back to you and then we go into common school fund? Where do those dollars go?
Madam Chair, Senator George, that's correct. Any revenue that we would generate from the territorial sea would be deposited directly into the common school fund.
Thank you very much.
All right. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your being here today. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 790, and we'll look at Senate Bill 875. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Bill 875 would require the posting of 100% bond for removal and restoration in order to obtain a permit to operate a wave energy facility. It would declare an emergency effective July 1st, 2007. We are waiting on both fiscal and revenue impact statements. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Carrie Thompson.
Actually, Steve Purchase wanted to come up. And
that would be fine.
And actually, the Water Resources Department, just first of all, let me explain that this bill was dropped some month and a half ago. And it was one of those bills that came out at the last moment when the Legislative Council was buried up to their eyeballs. And when I read the Water Resources Department, that wasn't what I intended, but that's what came out of Legislative Council, and I didn't have the heart to go down and tell them we're going to redraft this now and after they've just done that huge stack of bills. So that wording, I would think, would be better off put under Department of State Lands. And Steve has informed me that they are in the rulemaking process, and at the time this bill was drafted, the rulemaking process wasn't. I just got a copy. I haven't even had a chance to read them there. I don't think they're even out formally.
That's correct.
So, but let me tell you about what the bill intends to do, because I think that's one of the things that's important for this committee to understand. As wave action generator has a lot of support along the coast, but in the fishing industry, we're worried about the situation as these companies develop buoys and anchoring systems that are offshore in the traditional fishing grounds, that if a company goes bankrupt, who's going to clean up the mess? Every square foot out of the Oregon coast has a value to the fishing industry. And when you alter the bottom, it changes who gets to use it. So the goal in the bill is to make sure that there is money somewhere, either through an agency, the federal government, or from the wave action generator entity itself, to return that bottom to its original state. And that was the goal of the bill. And like I say, I think I'll turn this over to Steve Purchase. I mentioned one other thing. We've had a lot of experience in the fishing industry of hydropower being erected, like on the Klamath River, where they built a dam that has destroyed a fish run. And now, even though it's the Klamath River, it's impacting every fisherman that fishes for salmon up and down the whole Oregon coast and in some of the fisheries that don't. So the consequences of some of these power companies sometimes is not well understood at the time of their original implementation.
Steve? Madam Chair, members of the committee, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director, Department of State Lands. Wanted to speak today about this bill. We certainly understand what the intent of the bill is and the concerns that the fishing industry has. But I did want to take this opportunity to remind the committee that we already have this authority in our general leasing rules, and we are in the middle of proposing wave generation rules, leasing rules for the territorial sea that would allow us to have some discretion as to how much bond would be required, when the bond would be required, or the possibility of having the state of Oregon take over ownership of those facilities should they remain there. And I wanted that opportunity to let everybody know that we currently are doing this. It's our normal course of business. It's something we do with all of our lessees and all of our leases as part of our normal risk assessment when we enter into a lease. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So what you're telling us is we really don't need the bill in order to accomplish what the bill intends to accomplish.
Madam Chair, the bill would require 100% of restoration and removal costs. A bond is very expensive for a private company to get, and you know we may not require 100% restoration, but all of our leases also require lessees to return the land to its original condition. And should a company go bankrupt, you know, we'd certainly want to be able to tap into some kind of resource or some kind of financial resource to be able to accomplish that goal.
Yes, Senator Marcette.
With all due respect to the Bureau and any other state agency, I think administrative rules work well in some situations, and in other situations, a statutory fix, I think, would make sure after you're gone and so after we're gone that something will be done. So I
ain't leaving.
you ain't leaving.
No, not yet.
But I think there is a place for a statutory fix just to be sure something happens, and it isn't a reflection on the state lands or any other department. It's just a safeguard.
I agree.
All right. How do you feel about that, Mr. Thompson?
One thing about it is I think we have time in this case. I trust the Department of State Lands. I've worked with them before. I remember at the time of the bill, there wasn't anything formalized. We have at least a draft now that's moving forward. I'm more than willing to hold it over because I don't, the build-out plan on this, according to Ocean Power Technology, is the spring of 2008 will be a single buoy, and then there'll be 14 buoys in the fall of 2008. So there won't be a major operation off the coast of 2009. It gives us another legislative opportunity at that time. I'm excited about the potential for wave action power, but I'm also still very worried about the impact of the fishing industry. And we now have the FINE committee, which is fishermen involved in natural resources. That wasn't implemented at the time this came up, so things are moving so fast in this arena that I'm confident by the time we talk about major power operations that we'll have this in place through either another legislative hearing or through the Department of State.
All right. I have someone else to call up, so let's hear their testimony.
Thank you.
As well. Brendan McCartney. you'll introduce yourself.
Certainly.
For the record.
Brendan McCarthy, representing PGE. Thank you for having this hearing and giving me the opportunity to express just a couple of things. I'll be very brief. As you're well aware, I'm sure, been talked about right next door, the renewable portfolio standard is coming and will probably get us looking at all sorts of renewable power sources, one of which would be wave power. We're very excited about that, and PGE puts some money every year down at OSU in their research facility just for that reason. So we're excited about that resource. Looking at this bill, a couple of things jumped out at me. One is, and as Terry did mention, a 100% bond can be quite expensive for a company looking at putting in a resource. There are other examples in statute of reclamation, restoration type of provisions, one of which I'll just call out in 459-272 relating to landfills. And in that statute, what's allowed to be filed would be the establishment of a trust fund, a surety bond, a letter of credit, qualification as a self-insurer, or any combination of those methods. So I'd be happy to work with the committee if need be to address that issue, maybe broaden the 100% bond to some other forms of financial security. And as this moves forward, I understand there is this DSL process, and their rules are being developed. We would like to see some connection to perhaps the Energy Facility Siting Council or some other body to coordinate, make sure that this is all going to follow any siting issues that might come up in siting wave. And as I understand it, FERC has the overall, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has the overall authority on things developed in the ocean.
On the permitting process.
On the permitting process. We would just like to see, make sure that these things dovetail correctly. And that would be it. Thank you.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think that other utilities besides your own should be at the table in helping as we go through this process. Right now, there is the one wave energy pilot project at Gardner, but as Terry Thompson said, things are moving very fast in this area, and we want to be sure that we do it right. So I hope that you will continue to voice your eagerness to participate, and I will certainly watch that from my side. So
thank
that
you,
we'll be sure that you can do that. Senator George?
We have someone else here. But
Senator Representative Shaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I think, obviously, I think this is a prudent thing to do by looking at the sponsors. I think this will have great luck in this committee. And this is kind of the last bill, too, as a matter of fact, and I want, this is kind of a question for the department. Bond for removal and restoration in order to obtain permit to operate wave energy facility. That would, I would imagine, would your rules would also include any kind of other kind of drilling or exploration, or including oil, methane, natural gas. I just wanted to throw that out there, and I wish the proponents of the last bill were here to see the department nodding their head yes. So I just thought I'd get that on there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Senator George?
If you look at this bill in the relating clause, we can take this to be just a general statement, as the good Senator Morissette pointed out, that we intend for this seafloor to be restored to its original condition and will allow the agency then to negotiate on the basis of that, but it is intended of the legislature to have that restored. I'm just throwing that out, but I sure think we could do it pretty easily.
All right. I'm going to, in the essence of time, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 875. We have one more item on our agenda before we go to our informational meeting, and that is HJM 22. We have another bill that we were hoping would be brought at the same time so that Rob Bovet could be here to testify. Representative Cowan has agreed to talk a little bit about it. She is also on the bill. Representative Cowan, I think I'll have you hold off. We'll
That's fine.
Wait until Rob Bovet can be here and have both of you to do that. And so I'm going to move now to our informational meeting, the emergency notification systems. Invite our guests to the table and have you introduce yourself. Good. If you'll give them to the staff right there, you'll be happy to take care of you.
Yeah.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Bass. I'm president and CEO of Oregon Public Broadcasting. And after you've heard about Tamiflu, various things going on off the ocean, you might be wondering why the guy that brings you Sesame Street and Oregon Field Guide is here in front of this committee. Well, essentially, I'm here to talk with you and hopefully do a demonstration about our emergency alert system that is currently running on Oregon Public Broadcasting, both the emergency alert system, which runs during weather and seismic events, as well as the Amber Alert system that operates during child abduction emergencies. These systems use OPB's far-reaching network of television and radio stations, and our role in this has been derived from our historical relationship with the state, going back to, believe it or not, 1922, when we were put on the air at what was then the Oregon Agricultural College. But today we work very closely with the state's Emergency Management Agency, ensuring that public warnings are distributed far and wide. Now, we're at kind of a crossroads right now, which is why I wanted to talk with you today, that the emergency and Amber Alert systems are going to go in two decidedly different directions in the next 2 years. Either they are going to shrink to cover only our state's most populous areas, or we've got an opportunity to significantly enhance these systems with the same wide-ranging coverage that they have today. And the ability of OPB to do this depends on our ability to weather the upcoming end of the analog broadcasting system, which you might wonder, what is that all about? Well, in 700 days, exactly, 700 days from today, the federal government will be shutting off the analog television broadcasting system all over the United States. That is going to be a huge change. Now, broadcasting will continue in the digital mode, and some of you may have a digital television set or have heard a little bit about this, or so-called high-definition television. Thanks to funding from this legislature back in 2001, I'm going to put this aside because that's interfering with things. We have broadcast coverage digitally in the upper and lower Willamette Valley, much of central Oregon, the LeGrand area. That's all converted to digital through a $7 million lottery fund grant that this legislature made in 2001, which was matched by $15 million in federal and private sources. Now, when that funding was, a commitment was made by the state, the federal government at that point had not yet set an end date for analog broadcasting, nor had they put in place transition plan for translators, which are these little tiny broadcast transmitters that we have to use in all of the nooks and crannies of our great state, including the coast, the mountainous areas, and the valleys, in order to get television into those areas. Those translators now are the biggest challenge that we have, because all of our communities along the coast, in the Columbia Gorge, in mountainous southern and eastern Oregon, are served by what are soon to be obsolete analog transmitters. 700 days from today, they will be obsolete. We need those to cover, as I said, the mountains and the valleys. We have about 54 of them around the state that carry television broadcasts as well as these emergency alerts into those areas of Oregon. In total, those translators serve, we estimate, about 105,000 homes around Oregon, and some of them are in our most remote and rural areas, although there are some areas on the coast that are fairly populated, but we have this little problem in Oregon of these mountains that tend to get in the way of our broadcast signals. So what's going to happen on February 17, 2009 is that when we turn off the analog television system, we will continue to operate digitally in Portland, Corvallis, Eugene, Bend, and LeGrand, where we have these digital facilities. Our sister station in Medford, Oregon, Southern Oregon Public Television, will operate digitally on translators in Klamath Falls and Medford. But those 54 translators will no longer work because they need an analog source. They must be digital in order to work. So what will happen is we will lose service in those areas. Now, this isn't just a bad news story, and part of what I want to talk to you today about is the good news story, because with this upgrade of the digital broadcast infrastructure, we've got an incredible opportunity to improve our public warning system. Because in addition to sending out television broadcasts, we have this incredible capability now using a little bit of equipment here. In fact, let me just pick up. Don, do you have the box somewhere? Can you hold up the box, Mike? Colleague Don McKay, who's our head of engineering, let me just hold this up. This little box is plugged into the TV antenna that is on the roof here, and it is feeding this computer, which you can now see up there. And essentially what we have the ability to do is to feed not just TV sets with pictures and sound, but computers and computer networks with other sorts of information. So, for example, we could be sending out training information that goes onto computers and computer networks, or more to the point of this committee, we could be sending out emergency alerts that could go not only onto TV and radios, but onto computers, computer networks, and frankly, even this cell phone. Don, can we generate a... There we go. My cell phone just rang, and coming up on the screen, I don't know if you can see it, it says, Melissa Jones was abducted this morning at the Portland Mall. She is 4'3" tall and weighs 78 pounds. Came onto my cell phone, came onto this computer. Essentially, the way we did that is Don, using his Wi-Fi system, sent an alert, no wires. That went through the Internet, back up to Portland, out through our broadcast facility on our digital transmitter. We pulled it off on the antenna here into this computer. It simultaneously went into the singular cell phone network, rang this up. Now, we could also, for example, send a photo of Melissa Jones if we had a photo of her. We could send, if there was some other sort of an emergency, a file, a document, a spreadsheet. A video presentation. We could open up a special video channel that could be used by emergency first responders. All of this could be put out in the open. It could also be put in an encrypted or a secure basis, depending on how we wanted to do that. All of this is possible now. As I said, this is not, you know, we just did this right here. We've got a little bit of equipment in Portland to do this. The problem is that we can't push this out to places where we're not digital. So I can do it here because we've got easy access to our infrastructure in this area. Now, we didn't dim the lights, folks. That's not us. We can't control the lights yet. We're working on that. But what we can do is to start thinking about this network as being more than just something that can carry out television and radio. I like to think of this as being essentially a wireless broadband system that can be used for any number of uses. And, for example, one of the uses we thought is that we may be able to, and actually we could turn our digital translators, once we put them up, on the coast of Oregon into a tsunami alerting system. It could provide a backbone for that sort of thing. A tsunami alert comes in, we use the OPB broadcast infrastructure, you're walking down the beach, your cell phone rings. Oops, what does this one say? Two text messages have arrived. I don't know. There's too much going on here. Don is busy back there. But it tells you.
Evacuation.
Oh, an evacuation. Thank you. Thank you, Don. So there is a tsunami coming in. So as compared to right now, where you would have to be in your home watching a television set or being attuned to a radio to know that there's an alert, we have the possibility of a public warning system that can be anywhere and everywhere we need it. So what do we need in order to do this? Well, right now we have a problem of needing in 700 days to replace this analog television system. The price tag we estimate is about $5.5 million. Fortunately, the governor has included in what he calls his CHAMP package of investments in culture, history, arts, movies, and preservation, and OPB as well, a one-time capital grant of $2.75 million that would provide half of the capital funding we need for this network. There are some federal monies available that we believe could match it. We would be hopeful, and we hope we would be fortunate to get that match. In addition, the governor has proposed $1 million over the biennium to help us operate our broadcast services in rural areas, which is getting to be an increasingly big challenge. The funding was originally included in SB 5502, which is the Department of Administration Appropriation Bill. My understanding is we are not in that bill any longer. There may be another vehicle that Senator Johnson has putting forth. We're still trying to figure out how that is all going to come together. But I did want the opportunity to talk with you and show you some of these unique capabilities, because I think sometimes when we think about OPB and public broadcasting, people think about the very valuable programmatic function that we fulfill that has viewers and listeners all over the state of Oregon. But it's also good to start broadening our thinking. And as the state is making investments like this in OPB, we are very eager and very willing and very able to be working with the state of Oregon, not just to make people smarter about the world around them for our radio and television programs, but hopefully better prepared, smarter, and better and ready for more productive lives in our state. So with that, I'll stop, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have as to what we're doing and why.
You know, OPB is just a wonderful part of my life, and it always I always feel so much better after watching so many of the shows on OPB, and your attitude today reflects what you show on the screen as well. Good citizenship.
Thank you very much.
Wanting to cooperate. I want to really commend you for that, Senator Marsette.
Thank you. The analog digital is radio as well.
Well, there is an analog radio, but there is not a federal mandate that radio get go through a transition.
Okay.
So right now we're really only dealing with television, although we think over time radio will go digital as well.
Yeah, and just inside, I was able to listen to OPB all the way to Burns.
Yes.
In Ontario, all the way.
We're getting better on that. With television, we are in most areas of the state. Together with Southern Oregon Public Television, we have effectively reached almost every home in Oregon, even some of the most remote. Our hope is by weathering this digital transition, we can continue to do that for many years in the future.
Representative Shuffler.
And I have to share the good chair's sentiments. It's like, let me think. It's like cable and network is like the trans fat of television, and you're like the salad. It's really, you do feel better after you watch it. I swear to God, I'm so sick and tired of commercial television. I could just, well, anyway. So I greatly support you, and I wish it was a little less singing and dancing, a little more nature and field guide, but that's just my, and frontline and stuff like that. But on the phone thing there, the technological side, you said singular. I suppose that's just your carrier. You can hook into you have a deal with the phone companies where it would go out to everybody's cell phone?
Well, my understanding of that is that we are working with the federal government through FEMA. I know that's not the best name to bring up, but FEMA has been working on a digital emergency alert system that is going to become the federal standard. And interestingly, FEMA has selected public broadcasting as the backbone of that system. Mm-hmm. So there's a pilot that has been that is underway. We're part of the pilot, and they have been getting great cooperation from the cell phone carriers on this. I believe that Nextel was the first on board, but Singular obviously is on there as well. We have not delved into the politics of cell phone, which ones would do it and which ones wouldn't. My sense is that they're as public spirited and as interested in capabilities as anybody else.
Yeah,
and because there's a federal mandate for this as well, I think it's tending to get them to come on board.
Wow. Thank you.
The question has come up, could first responders use this system as a way of communicating?
Well, yes, but not in the way that some other systems are used for communicating. There are other mandates and other protocols like interoperable communications that I'm sure this committee and others have dealt with. That is an entirely different subset of issues. What this system is really good at is sending relatively large files or very important messages out
quickly and accurately. This is not a two-way system. So if you were looking for a way that firefighters could talk to each other, this would not be the right system. This, though, is the sort of system that, for example, if you were fighting a forest fire and needed to bring live video to a subset of people and everybody needed to tap into that, or a subset of people, it's a very good way of doing that. Or I was thinking earlier when there was some testimony here about the possibility of the bird flu. This could provide a way that the state could, in a sense, have its own closed circuit channel to allow, for example, health officials to be talking either, you know, confidentially or securely with folks or anything else. But it is not an interoperable communication solution. That's entirely different.
Right. Questions? All right. Well, I guess that I'm thinking what kind of assurances that we have that in cases of a crisis that you can stay on the air.
Well, I would not say that we are hardened in the way that government facilities are. We have a very reliable network. We do have generator capacity. We have a pretty well distributed network. So if something happens in one place, it doesn't mean we may be completely off the air. The things we have to worry about are things like seismic activities that might topple towers or destroy buildings. In that case, I think everybody is pretty well in the same boat.
Yeah, that's right. Well, this has been very, very interesting, and thank you so much for coming today.
I think you got a question.
Yes. Oh, Representative Krieger?
I couldn't get by without saying something all day.
You said this is going to take place in 700 days. Is everybody's older TV going to be obsolete?
That's one of the questions I get asked very frequently. The answer is both yes and no. If you have an old TV that you use over-the-air broadcast, you know, rabbit ears to get, as of February 17, 2009, that TV set will receive nothing unless you get a converter box that you hook it up to. Now, the federal government is going through a standards process, and in fact, they are going to have a subsidy program for consumers to go buy these boxes. Any newer TV will work just fine. If you're hooked up to cable or satellite, you should be fine. Our particular challenge with regard to cable is that we use our broadcast infrastructure for delivering our signal to cable systems out in rural Oregon. So, in a sense, it's a chicken and egg thing. If we don't have the broadcast infrastructure, it's not going to get to cable. But I will tell you that consumers are going to be and already are enormously confused by this, that we are expecting a great deal of angst and confusion on February 17th, 2009.
Well, maybe we'll be in special session. regular session. We'll fix it.
You may not want to answer your phone that day. That would be my recommendation.
Well, I think you've done a good thing today. I think that you have educated a whole group of people so that we are already alerted now to some of the ways that some of your needs, some of the ways that you're going to be funded, and we'll be watching for a bill that might be coming through. So you've done a good thing by being here besides alerting us to the possibilities of what you can do. So thank you again, and thank you for participating as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Appreciate it.
All of you heard me give the update on Representative Boone, which is just great. And we're happy that she had her surgery on Monday, and she's doing quite well. She'll be in the hospital two more days, and then she'll be home. And you should have all received an email with her home address so that you can send cards or flowers or whatever you want to do to remember her as she gets well. I think that her surgery, while she's doing well, is certainly a painful one. So we certainly want to keep her in our thoughts. And if there is no other business to come before this body, I'll call the meeting adjourned.
All right.